Beacon Press Audio presents Drive, Scraping By in Uber's America, One Ride at a Time, by Jonathan Rigsby. This audiobook is narrated by Ryan Self. Published by Beacon Press Audio 2024. Introduction. When I was a teenager, I had a television in my bedroom that I inherited from my brother's room after he moved out. My parents gave it to me with the promise that I wouldn't let it distract me from my schoolwork. At night, long after my parents went to sleep, I would stay up and do homework or play video games on my computer with the TV on in the background. I mostly put it on as a companion. With very few friends and a limited social life, I felt less alone hearing the voices of other people in the background. In those days, there was this show called Taxi Cab Confessions that came on just after Dennis Miller finished his political talk show. The show's premise was simple. A taxi driver in some city, usually Las Vegas, would pick people up and hidden cameras would record them as they talked about their most private and intimate secrets. As a kid, I was fascinated by the things people would admit to a total stranger. There were wild discussions of drug use, sexual escapades, and stories of such immense sadness that I found them difficult to believe. Even though the show included a disclaimer at the start that the people involved had signed a waiver to release the footage, I knew that the show had to be scripted. There was no way people would admit the types of things they said to those cab drivers. I had always believed that things would just work out. As long as I worked hard, my natural intelligence would carry me through. My parents told me I was smart and capable. Surely others would see the same in me, and the world would be my oyster. It wasn't until a drunk lobbyist berated me for missing the turn onto his street that I realized how wrong I had been. Between bouts of yelling into his phone that the senator had better change the bill if he wanted to see another dime from the lobbyist's clients, he told me in no uncertain terms that my failure to spot a street sign in the dark of an unfamiliar neighborhood was the result of my faulty upbringing and mentally deficient parents. As he got out, I told him to have a nice night. He told me to go fuck myself. If you've never worked in a service industry, you may think you'd never put up with being treated that way. But all across America, it's the daily reality of servers and cashiers and anyone who lives paycheck to paycheck. Which is more people than you think. When you are desperate, truly desperate, you'll swallow your pride if it means you don't have to be hungry anymore. There's an ugly truth that hides in the gaudy background of the American dream. You can do everything right and still fail. I was privileged enough to attend a world-class university after high school. My parents paid for my undergraduate degree, and I assumed meaningful work would automatically follow. I drifted from my home in Alabama to Washington, D.C., then back to my hometown of Montgomery. I worked in a local video game store while saving money and applying to graduate school, flush with dreams of saving the world with a degree in international relations. After two rounds of applications, I was accepted to another university in Chicago. I reunited with my girlfriend from college as we moved to the Windy City together. For the next 2 years, I studied hard. My dream job was just around the corner. Any day now, I thought, it would all work out. Job after job fell through, and by the time I graduated, I had nothing lined up. My girlfriend, now my fiancé, had been accepted to a graduate program in Tallahassee, and we moved to Florida so she could go to school. I worked part-time at another local video game store before landing a steady full-time job working for the state of Florida's Child Welfare Program, the Department of Children and Families, DCF. Finally, I felt I could find my feet. My fiancé and I were going to make a home. It was an unusual position, that first real job. The agency needed a DCF person to sit inside the headquarters of the state police and help coordinate the response when children in foster care went missing. A system in Florida filed dozens of reports each day for children who ran away from foster care, and any time they weren't quickly located, a case would be opened with the state missing persons clearinghouse. For the next 3 years, I spent my days diligently reading through the case files of abused and neglected children, searching for information that might be helpful in locating them when they went missing. In each case, I read through the allegations and notes from the caseworkers, absorbing a world of abuse, abandonment, and neglect. I learned to recognize the signs that a foster child was involved in sex trafficking and notified care agencies when children were being victimized. It was, by turns, brutal and rewarding. The sheer darkness of the work took a toll on me mentally, and I would sometimes find myself crying in my car after a particularly disturbing case came up. Constantly reading about child abuse was difficult, but it became unbearable when my newly married wife told me she was pregnant. In every file, every broken bone and hollow-eyed victim statement, I saw my own child and wondered how such things were possible. As I was isolated from the main office at DCF, my work went largely unnoticed. But within the law enforcement world, my analytical abilities were being discussed behind closed doors. I was quietly encouraged to apply for a position as an intelligence analyst in the counterterrorism section. And, after a series of interviews, the job was mine. Things slowly began to fall into place. I was moving into a career that I was proud of, and my wife and I were experiencing the sleep-deprived joy of our first child. On the other side of the country, a group of software engineers were perfecting a new way of working. Flush with millions in venture capital, they had launched an app that would allow users to call a private car to drive them to their destination. They hired computational neuroscientists, nuclear physicists, and an army of programmers to design a system that allowed any person to sign up and use their personal vehicle as a taxi. With infinite money and a brain trust dedicated to finding ways to exploit the reward pathways of the human brain, the system was designed to shift costs onto the vulnerable individuals who just needed a little bit of extra money to make ends meet. By the time my life fell apart and I signed up to become a rideshare driver, the entire ecosystem was already established. Waves of drivers were signing up every week to wear out their personal vehicles, driving strangers back and forth across town for meager earnings. In Uber's offices, executives reveled in the endless praise of the media who lauded them for disrupting the stagnant taxi industry. Across the country, an army of drivers was chasing a phantom dream of being one's own boss, shuttling people to and fro over long nights and early mornings, while Uber's executives appeared on magazine covers. The nature of work in America was changing, transforming so rapidly that traditional structures could barely react to the rapid decay of the American lifestyle. In the 1990s, futurists had dreamed of a world where technology would make every person's life safer, easier, and more rewarding. Far from a safety net, technology reinvented the sweatshop model of piecemeal work that had once been abolished in America by pesky regulations like minimum wage. And millions fell into the system because traditional work no longer paid the bills. The new method had its own name, one that soon became ubiquitous, the gig economy. People were now free to work when and where they wanted. So long as they chose to forgo decent earnings and workplace safety, the sky was the limit. By placing all of the earnings responsibility on the drivers, Uber had perfected a passive model of wealth extraction. Do none of the actual work, and skim a percentage of the money earned by drivers for the company. That the system was not yet profitable was a problem to be handled in the future. As long as customers preferred a stranger's barely regulated vehicle to a taxicab, rideshare would grow like a weed, and the model it presented would eventually be adapted to everything from food delivery to grocery shopping. The technology created a world of digital servants that lived just out of sight, but could be conjured into existence to provide consumers with any number of services. At the tap of a screen, your own personal genie would bring you your heart's desire. Just don't think too hard about whether the genie has to sleep in their car at night. I spent many hours in my car mulling over the events that led to my state of precarity. But even if I was isolated from friends and family, I wasn't alone. Over thousands of rides, passengers listened to me just as I listened to them. In ride after ride, I shared myself with total strangers, and they, in return, revealed their fears, hopes, and secrets to me. Their lives were heartbreaking, touching, surprising, and even humorous in equal measure. I struggled with poverty. I raged at the universe for its indifference to my suffering. I despaired that things would never be different. Then I tapped on my phone and picked up another ride. Eventually, I found a way through, but not before having to relearn everything I thought I had known about what matters in life. What you're about to read is the story of one father, 3 years, and more than 8,000 rides. This is a story about how I rebuilt my life from behind the wheel of a car. It's a story about letting go of my dreams and learning to live with reality, about focusing on the things in life that really matter. Family, love, and happiness. But this isn't just my story. It's a story that's being repeated across the United States countless...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?